Welcome, everybody. It's episode 6 of the Association Marketing Show. I'm your host, Abhay Khurana, the CMO here at Feather, and today I'm joined by John Loftus, Event Marketing Manager at the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners. John, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So before jumping into some detailed questions, can you tell me a little bit about your personal and professional background, maybe how you got into the association world?
I've been with the ACP for almost 16 years. Back then, Austin wasn't really the bustling metropolis it is now. I had some specific requirements when I was looking for a job for a company that, or an organization that had a good mission, but also wanted to go into marketing. And I looked for a while and didn't really find what I was looking for, but did see a member services representative opportunity open up with the ACFE. Sat at the front desk, made coffee, put mail in mailboxes, and then answered phones. So that was my start, and then worked in product marketing, membership marketing, and now event marketing and virtual event everything basically right now.
So. What does ACFE do? I mean, obviously some of it is in the name, but what are the kind of the industry that it serves and the kind of lineup of member services and resources and key events, et cetera, that you all put on and provide for your industry?
So the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, we have 85,000 members worldwide, and the industries are all over the place and professions. But the main mission for everyone is typically our members are involved in finding fraud or preventing fraud in some way. We also do a report every 2 years called the Report to the Nations, where we survey our members and find out more about fraud and release this, as a 45 or 50 page report about what is happening in fraud. And, you know, those stats are used all over the place. You'll see the Wall Street Journal and other major publications will quote those in a lot of articles because it's the best research out there on how much fraud is actually happening.
It touches everybody, it seems like. You know, there's the professional side of it, but fraud affects or has the potential to affect literally everybody these days. So it seems to have general public interest as well. Talk to me a little bit about your typical event lineup, obviously pre-COVID, and you've mentioned some of these other really key member benefits and programs. 15 years at one organization, especially in these days, is somewhat rare. Would you attribute that mostly to ACFE kind of being responsive and giving you more and more opportunities as you've become kind of ripe for them?
Yeah, totally. Like, I've had the opportunity to continue to move up, and I think our executives were willing to give me opportunities in times where I wasn't exactly qualified from an experience standpoint. My move into product marketing actually happened when our product marketing manager left. I was still in member services and our annual conference was 2 months away. So they gave me an opportunity to run our bookstore at the event. And while I was still in member services, so kind of running the special project while also doing my main job. And I did so well at that they created a new position for me to move into marketing after that was all over with. So as I've kind of grown with the organization, they've been very responsive and kind of making sure that I had a path to continue to grow, which has been amazing.
What did your typical event lineup look like, you know, given your specialization in event marketing? You know, how many events were you responsible for, you know, marketing and helping to support in a typical year before 2020?
So we would do 40 to 50 in-person events a year. And the format ranged from, you know, two-day deep dive trainings into a specific topic, into one-day summits, and then our conferences, where we have conferences across the world. You know, they're different tracks, different sessions kind of broken up, and to our largest one being our global conference that happens every year in the summer. And it has, you know, usually like 100 plus sessions. The attendees were about 3,500 attendees, and it was our global conference. So we'd have people from the US, but then also I think the last year, 2 years ago, we had 80 different countries represented at our conference.
At the global,
so that's our kind of our milestone conference.
Before we get into 2020 and then carrying into 2021, the whole virtual event pivot and all of the work that's gone into that and everything that you've learned about that, you were in the unique position going into COVID land that you had been doing virtual events for some amount of time, and so therefore had a little bit of a background, a little bit of experience working with virtual events and all of the production challenges that come along with that, and figuring all of that out. So how long before 2020 were you and ACFE running hybrid events?
We did our annual conference started in 2016 as a hybrid option. We've done webinars since like 2006.
Yeah.
So it was pretty much one per year, and that was our big conference.
Right. Okay. So COVID hits March at like ish, March-ish, it becomes abundantly clear to everybody that live events are not going to be happening anytime soon, practically anywhere in the world. And you were in the unique position that you have, or you had, a live event coming up in a matter of weeks. So talk to me about how you like quick pivoted to make that European event, which was in late March, I believe, how you were able to pull that off and take that virtual so quickly. And then briefly kind of what happened for the rest of the year.
Yeah, that was, so people kind of joke that 2020 felt like 5 years long, and it really does, looking back. Like, it's hard to believe it's only been a year. But for our Euro conference, yeah, we had 3 weeks to pivot from in-person to virtual. Mm. And 3 weeks isn't a whole lot to do much of anything. So we kind of looked at the technology we use currently for our webinars and some of the other things we do, or self-studies, and just figured out a way to use our existing technology to deliver that conference as best we could. Mm. So it was almost like we did a bunch of mini webinars versus like using a whole like virtual event platform. And then we just kind of brought it all together with a landing page that kind of linked off to each of the sessions. So it wasn't ideal, but it worked on the time that we had to do that.
Right.
And then for our annual conference, we had 2.5 months, which felt a lot more comfortable than 3 weeks, but still not nearly enough time.
Yeah.
So we actually used ON24 for our webinars, okay. And they had a couple virtual event platforms that we had enough time to kind of bring on before our annual conference to use for that.
Yeah.
And that one, we ended up doing 93 sessions virtually over 2.5 days, which was crazy. I'm still tired.
I'm sorry. you just need like a 60-day nap to get over that or something.
Yeah, but it was good too, because you know, like, we had almost 4,500 attendees, which I mentioned earlier, typically in person, you know, we were anywhere from 3,000 to 3,500.
Right.
And it opened a lot of opportunities for new people to attend, because before they couldn't afford travel, they couldn't get their business to approve, you know, hotel stays, things like that. So we actually learned that there's a whole market of people that couldn't do our training before because of that, who were able to attend that conference, which was awesome.
Yeah.
The Association Marketing Show is brought to you by Feather, the all-in-one digital marketing toolkit built just for associations. To learn more about our tools and services, check us out at feather.co. That's FEATHR.co.
And then from there, like, things went well enough, but we felt comfortable to continue using that technology for a lot of our events. So we did, in 2020, I think 50 or more. I lost count of how many events we've done virtually.
Yeah.
But we took everything we could and create it in a virtual environment. Yeah. So we did our 2-day conferences or 2-day events.
Hmm.
We moved virtually our CFE exam review course, which is the live prep course that we offer for people trying to get their CFE credential.
Hmm.
We started hosting that virtually. You know, we messed around with some interactive workshops, actually using Zoom and breakout rooms to replace some of the interactive workshops we do in person.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we've tried all kinds of different things. We've done half day long webinars. We've done, you know, webinars spread over a week. You know, being virtual, we've just taken the mentality that we're going to try a lot of different things and see what attendees like.
Yeah.
And, you know, do more of that.
Yeah. 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 That's one thing that's really impressed me as we've talked, is like how deep you went into virtual event world and all the experiments that you ran and like how far you pushed or you attempted to push the envelope in terms of the kinds of in-person experiences that you can replicate virtually. You really kind of tried the gamut, right? It's from interactive style workshops, which like on the surface seemed to be, you know, would be difficult to pull off virtually, but still like, hey, how can we make that happen? What technology do we need? How can we plan that attendee experience to make that as good as possible while we can't do an in-person version, to like really education heavy, you know, longer events or educational sessions, 2-day things, 3-day things, half day things, week long series with content kind of distributed throughout. You've tested so much. And with 50 events in 2020, looking back, what have been kind of like the standout learnings that come to mind for you in terms of successfully producing and marketing and running a virtual event? What are some of the kind of key lessons that you would communicate to the rest of association professionals, marketing professionals that are listening here to kind of shortcut and give them a leg up based upon your experience and your learnings running 50 events? What comes to mind both as like successes that you've learned and things that you tried that maybe weren't so successful that people could take away and use that to shortcut their process?
Yeah, that's a lot. So I would say like one thing that I think really made our team successful was people were able to kind of take on roles that weren't necessarily in their job description.
Right.
And part of that was just doing a lot of training and making sure people were comfortable with the platform. And, you know, we had our event planners who typically be getting new contracts for venues who were producers. So they would get on and they would train speakers how to use the platform. And the day of the event, they were the ones, you know, opening the sessions and answering questions and things. So I think investing a lot of time in training, even though, you know, you may feel like you don't have a lot of time, allowed us to kind of scale up, I think, because we took people, gave them a new skill set really quickly, and were able to not have a bottleneck of only 3 people knew how to use virtual events when we had 25 people now that could help us produce and execute events. So I think that training people outside of even their normal responsibilities to do virtual events so that, you know, when you need them, they're there and ready to go.
Yeah. That seems huge, both on the internal side, but as well as like the partner speaker side. It's like a live event. There's just, it's, you're in person doing your thing. It's like, it's natural, right? It's, you have the room where you're speaking in, kind of, and you're prepped and you prep your content and then you take questions in the room. Like all of those behaviors and activities are very normal at this point, but carrying them out, just the simple act of doing those same things in a virtual environment requires training, and that can feel like a burden, like you're saying, or that can feel like something that seems, I don't know, like not worth the time, or something that you wish you didn't have to do, right? With a live event, that is of course much less needed, but you have to build the foundation. You have to make sure everybody's comfortable with the technology, comfortable with the video and the audio, and that's just a new layer of responsibility that we have to successfully pull off virtual events these days.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think another thing that really kind of made us successful is just the mentality of the team towards like being open to trying new things, potentially failing, or, you know, getting that feedback of, you know, this event really wasn't what I thought it would be, or I really didn't like this thing. Being able to learn from that and kind of have that growth mindset of like, okay, so that thing we tried didn't really work, you know, let's try something different. You know, and some of these things we're learning, like one of our events, we shortened lunch to like 15 minutes so we could shorten the day. And the feedback wasn't great. People were like, I need my 30 minutes. I need my hour. You know, I got to answer my emails in between sessions. So, you know, just being flexible and open, I guess having thick skin a little bit to kind of take that constructive feedback and improve your events as you go.
Cause
there's more flexibility virtually.
Yeah.
And then the other thing we're learning is like, as much as people want to push this online networking, there's a large, at least for our audience, a large majority of people don't want to be on camera. You know, they don't don't necessarily want to network. A lot of them are just coming for education. So like your audience may not want to sit in a virtual happy hour networking reception mm-hmm. after training. Like,
yeah,
we've had a couple of those where we show up and, you know, there aren't a whole lot of people there, and it's like, well, maybe yeah. there's just not the demand for that we thought there would be. You know, like, we sit on Zoom and Teams calls all day, and maybe by the time they're done, they don't want that, you know, like,
yeah,
I don't know.
We've seen that some as well. We're obviously not producing virtual events, but we're working with a lot of associations and event organizers who are, and we've also sponsored a dozen plus virtual events and participated in them over the last 6 months. And that's been a theme that we've noticed as well, is it's much more difficult to pull off virtual networking. Partially, I think that's technology based. But I think also part of that is just audience appetite, right? It's like, yeah, like you're saying, especially when it's towards the end of the day, people have been at home in their chairs on Zoom with the screen in their face, feeling a little bit tired probably. And an end of the day kind of virtual networking experience, which is not that great anyways, especially compared to live, where you have, you know, all of the full kind of live networking experience, that's not super compelling. The other thing that I think might be underlying that a little bit is that when somebody's at a live event and they've traveled and you know, they've booked lodging to be at that live event, like, that's all they're doing. You're not competing with other options of ways that they can spend their time. Like, I remember this attending all kinds of events before 2020. I was at that place for 2 nights and you know, 3 days, and all I was doing was participating in the event. So I had nothing else to do at 5 o'clock when there was a networking happy hour. Even if I wasn't that into it, like, that was the best thing I could do with my time. And so I would go, not because I was super jazzed about that as a kind of experience format as an attendee, but just because I was there, I traveled there, I didn't have anything else to do really. And so I think that one of maybe like the hidden benefits of going virtual is like, participation is much more voluntary. And attendees, through their participation, are probably giving you feedback about what kind of experiences they prefer and don't prefer in general, not even just in a virtual environment. Whereas like with live events, you know, maybe if you're an event organizer or you're part of the team, you go to the networking happy hour at the end of the day and you see a bunch of people there, and that's a sign to you that, oh, this is good, we should keep this for next year. Whereas actually there might not be so much interest and appetite for that from a attendee driven standpoint, but they're kind of just going with the flow because that's what they're there to do. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I think there's also that expectation of, you're a virtual event, you're still available, right? You get your work done, you still answer your email. And in person, I think that sometimes it's a little less like, oh, so-and-so is in Vegas for this conference, they're not gonna be replying to email for 3 days.
Yeah.
Oh, he's sitting at his desk anyway at a conference. He should be sitting here answering my instant right. messages, you know, like that's, right. I think that's a challenge too.
Yeah. In some ways, I feel like the bar for the quality of a virtual event experience has been raised compared to their live event counterparts because of the abundance of distractions and other opportunities and other options for people spending their time. So yeah, it's a challenge, but we can rise to meet it. I think the bar has been raised, like you're saying. That's cool. So ending the year, maybe some of the later events that you pulled off in the year, apart from this kind of networking insight and lunch break time being important for people to kind of, yeah, break and refresh to come back for an afternoon session, for example, what are some of the things that really changed for you and for your team between how you ran events early on in COVID to how you pulled them off in December? Kind of what I'm getting at is like, what did you learn in that time that translated into practical changes, and how you pulled off the production and the promotion of your events?
So the first couple were just, how are we going to do this? How do we get this done? And, you know, it was very like just figuring out as we were going. But, you know, after we were pretty heavy with virtual events through November, and December, we kind of sat down and came up with some SOPs for what we were doing and actually writing down like, this is how we do this and this is how we do that. And here's a timeline typically for what a virtual event looks like, you know? So we were way more organized and it was less reactive and more proactive to a virtual event, which was a nice change to be able to say like, by this date, we're doing all of our tech calls with speakers. And by this date, we should have all our slides in. And I think it took a lot of the stress away that we were having with virtual events, just because, you know, we really were just trying to survive for the most part. And then now we're just trying to, you know, make these manageable long term, because, you know, I don't think virtual events are going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah. Could you elaborate on those SOPs a little bit? Like, basically, like, if somebody listening is trying to get to that place of having standard operating procedures for putting on virtual events, what are like the main things in those SOPs that you consider to be most critical for, yeah, like successfully producing and promoting a virtual event? You know, like, what are the key timelines that need to happen on time? You mentioned tech prep calls with speakers. You mentioned having slides in for any presentations. Are there any kind of like other really big rocks that are like the key deadlines and milestones within your SOP docs?
So part of it is a focus on the technical side of like just setting things up. So we did a lot of SOPs on the tech setup.
Yeah.
You know, like we talked through a little bit earlier about like trying to scale your staff, and, you know, we created SOPs for the tech part so that anybody can go in and set up a webinar or a virtual event, you know, so we're not just waiting on one person to do that.
Yeah.
And then from like a production standpoint, you know, typically we would do a tech call with a speaker about a week before, just to go through the platform and show them what it looks like and the functionality of those things. And then we would have, for certain speakers, a second content call. And a lot of times that's more your keynote speakers or panels, where you actually walk through the session and what they're going to cover. You know, and then we would do some of the setup work would be done in that time. And we would have our internal like producer training calls. So any of our producers for an event, we would get on and go, here's the platform and here's how you use it.
Yeah.
Here are things to check for, to make sure on day of, like, make sure the link to the slides that's on the page actually goes to the right slides, and like some of the QA checklists for that.
Right.
So I would say like just thinking through your process, because my SOP is not necessarily going to work for everybody else, but thinking through your process of your event.
Right.
And the things that could possibly go wrong, and then try and plan to mitigate those things. That's why we do tech calls in advance. Our European conference, we did a lot of sessions and had a lot of issues with internet, where I think if we had been able to have a week to do tech calls in advance, we could have caught some of those things.
Gotcha.
And we also have our speakers log in an hour before their session, because a lot can change between a tech call and the session. In terms of like just their quality of internet or anything like that. So, you know, for our first conference, people would show up 10 minutes before their session, and we would scramble to get their cameras working and make sure their audio was good.
Yeah.
Where for, you know, now it's like an hour before a conference session starts, we have the speaker on, and sometimes it's awkward that we're just sitting there, you know, when everything works, it's great. But when it doesn't, you know, we've had sessions that have gone down to a minute before the session begins, and it's taken us that long to figure out, like, oh, they're on 5G. We need to switch them back to a regular network, or maybe we need to restart their router or their computer or whatever. So, like, having that hour makes a big difference, because there's a lot of things you can troubleshoot that might not be working.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Let me ask you about the marketing and the promotion. How has that gone, especially in a world where, you know, 50 virtual events in 9 months-ish, right? That's a lot. You have probably at any given time multiple virtual events that are in like the promotion cycle, so to speak, that you're promoting. And so that can be a challenge sometimes. How do you make sure that the right people are getting the right messages, maybe not confused by all the different options that are available to them? So talk to me about how the marketing has gone, how you've adjusted your marketing strategy, what channels that you use for promoting these virtual events, and some of the challenges that have come up, and how you've tackled them from a marketing and from a comms standpoint.
Yes, it's definitely challenging, because when you have a virtual event, like, your only restriction almost becomes the time zone. And even then, you know, we've seen people from across the world attend events live where they're up at 1 a.m. At an event so they can attend. So it's like, how do you do that? And then part of that is just communicating with our teams very well and prioritizing who's getting what email, you know. So we'll look at like previous attendee data for conferences and prioritize those folks to get more conference related emails. Gotcha. Where we'll look at like, and I'd love to get a little bit further in our, in, into where we're at with our data, but sometimes it's just they indicated on their profile they're interested in computers and technology. So we're going to prioritize this event about computer fraud or cyber fraud, while everyone else might get a more general event. You know, we've started to try and look at, you know, people who attended this event might also be interested in this other event that's somewhat related or maybe builds on that the previous event. And then, you know, when we're sending 3 or 4 emails a day, making sure we have a rule that people only get one per day. So making sure that we prioritize who gets what just by, you know, looking at data and then communicating internally to make sure that we're sending the right message to the right people.
Yeah.
And the then we've done more, more general type marketing. So before you do, if you were at an event in Philadelphia, you know, you would market to pretty much everybody in that range, but we've started doing more like, we'll send a postcard out with like the next 5 upcoming virtual events to an audience, or we'll send out an email that's kind of more general. We even do a Feather campaign, remarketing campaign on a monthly basis. It's kind of the same thing. It's an ad that shows our next few events that are upcoming so that people can kind of see, like, we know they're interested in those events and we let them kind of self-select when we hit them that way too. So that's another way, is just focused on that general marketing.
Yeah. It sounds like a great one too. Like, you have your general marketing. It's like almost embracing the fact that you have a lot going on and being open and transparent about that and not trying to be like too clever with segmentation so that, you know, any given audience member only thinks you have one thing going on because you've segmented their emails and their remarketing campaigns and whatever to just show them the one event that you think is going to be most interesting to them. It's like embracing the breadth of content that you are providing in the form of your virtual events, giving people the opportunity to see all of them over the next, you know, the ones that are coming up in the, over the next month or two, and then self-select the ones that they care about, as well as in some cases kind of proactively promoting the things that they've indicated the most interest in. So you're kind of giving people both sides of like that marketing approach, both general and transparent about everything that's going on and giving them the opportunity to self-select, and then also proactively suggesting things that you think are going to be most relevant or interesting to them based upon the data that you have about them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. What other channels? You mentioned email and remarketing. Are those kind of like the main two that you're relying on mostly for getting the word out about your virtual events? Anything else in the mix?
We do a lot of social marketing, LinkedIn, Facebook, some Instagram.
Yeah.
And then we still do a lot of direct mail, believe it or not. I think some people have kind of moved away from direct mail, but you know, it's one way to cut through the clutter, you know, and just trying to figure out ways to communicate. So like we talked about that upcoming events, email and ad, but then we also send an upcoming events postcard. And hopefully by this point, everyone's updated their addresses and they're getting to the right place, but we've seen a good result from still doing direct mail.
Yeah. Cool. One thing that I wanted to get into, and you mentioned this a couple questions ago, was you don't think that virtual events are going anywhere. And part of that is, of course, because like the time window for the pandemic is continuing, right? And so that's, I'm sure, part of what's informing that statement. But what is your thinking, say, like even next year, as difficult as it is to think a year in advance, when live events are back in the mix? Even when live events are back full tilt, however long that takes, what have you learned about virtual events, and where do you think that they still live or they should still live within kind of the mix and the strategy for an association? Do you intend to keep them going at a higher rate and clip like you're at right now, even in a world where you can pull off your live events? And what do you think the kind of relationship between live events and virtual events and how they're used is going to look like in a world where live events are back on the table?
Yeah, I think that our long-term plan was always to add some kind of virtual component to our trainings. It was just one of those things where it was a longer process that we thought would take a couple of years to start testing and trying things out, and where we were kind of forced to do it very quickly. But you know, what we're seeing and the feedback we're getting is there's a new audience of people that are able to interact and attend things that couldn't before because they're virtual. But yeah, there's still the people on the surveys that say, oh, well, in person's better, you know, like I can't wait for in-person events to get back. So I think that there's two unique audiences that have kind of emerged from virtual events, and there's going to continue to be that demand for virtual events moving forward, both from the people that prefer it and also from the people where their businesses have learned, like, oh, I don't have to pay for travel. I don't have to pay for food. Yeah. I don't have to send my employee off to Vegas. I can just have them do this online.
Yeah.
You know, and we're also seeing, like, I can train 3, 4, or 5 people for the same price of sending one person to a virtual event. So I think that, you know, they're going to have people that prefer virtual events, businesses who are going to just generally prefer their employees attend virtual events. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, we're just going to continue to see virtual events be in demand. So like I said, I don't think they're going to go anywhere. I don't know if we could sustain 50 plus virtual events in addition to in-person.
Yeah.
You know, and trying to think through, like, hybrid events might be one way to do it. But then also, like, the challenge with hybrid events is, you know, there's more risk there. There's more investment in technology, and there's more spend on site to have production crews and things like that. So I don't think we've quite figured out what we want to do from that standpoint. But yeah, for sure. The demand for virtual events is just going to continue. So long term, they're not going to go anywhere. And we're going to continue to offer virtual events in some form or fashion. Part of that just kind of depends on how we emerge from the pandemic and how long it's going to take. But I definitely think we'll be doing virtual events for quite a long time.
Yeah. How's 2021 rather shaping up from a schedule standpoint? How many, sorry, I see the look on your face, but how many virtual events is it looking like you're scheduled to pull off this year?
I honestly don't know, you know, like every day you look at the news, it's something different, you know, it's like, oh, we've got a vaccine. Oh, there's a new strand of COVID. We're not sure if the vaccine's going to do anything about this. Yeah. And then you see travel restrictions and things like that. So I think in a perfect world, you know, like Q3, Q4, we're starting to have in-person events again. But I think also we're kind of holding off right now because it's, who knows, you know, like no one thought a year ago we would be sitting here talking about having 50 plus virtual events and all our conferences being virtual. Yeah. So it's like, we're definitely doing virtual events. You know, it might be 50 or more again this year, but we kind of just are trying to keep up with current events and see, like, what are we, and strategize as we go. So being kind of flexible to what's going on.
Yeah. Makes sense. Cool. Well, I've got just a few kind of like quick fire questions for you to end the podcast here today. And the first one that I like to ask is, at this stage in your career, you know, 15 years in with the same organization, have you learned anything that you wish you could go and tell yourself at the beginning of your career? Like, what advice would you give John 15 years ago, getting into ACFE and getting into marketing?
Control what you can, and, you know, don't stress about the rest of it, you know, because there's a lot of things that are out of our control. And I've learned that, you know, working in events now, and especially after the last year, is, you know, don't stress about things you can't control, and do what you can about the things you can control.
Yeah. That's great. Not the easiest thing to do sometimes, but that's an amazing tip. Another one is, if you could wave a magic wand and solve any professional challenge for yourself, besides having unlimited budget and or like making the pandemic disappear, what would you use that magic wand for?
Oh, do I get 3 wishes?
Yeah. Okay, just for you.
I'm thinking, I think data, you know, having clean data is a big challenge for associations, especially who don't have large teams that can focus on data. So having accurate and relevant data so that the marketing we're doing and the things we're targeting and segmenting actually are relevant to the person's receiving it. So you know, clean data would be my wish.
Cool. Any others? You said you wanted three wishes.
I feel sometimes even pre-COVID from an association standpoint that our teams are kind of siloed a little bit. I've talked to other associations that kind of feel the same. So like figuring out how to unsilo teams to get, because I think that does cause some issues sometimes. So that would be another wish of mine.
Yeah, these are both great ones. Cool. Well, John, thank you so much for joining and dropping all this experience on us of running 50 plus virtual events in 2020. It's been super useful just to kind of like peel back the curtain on your processes. Sounds like a lot of it is being diligent about the fundamentals and about the basics and making sure everybody knows what's going on and there's good communication and things are done well in advance to pull things off successfully. And I love all those tips that you've shared, and also about the marketing and the promotion strategies and how you've handled things there. So there's a lot of good stuff here around virtual events, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to this episode, and we will see you on the next one.
The Association Marketing Show is brought to you by Feather, the all-in-one digital marketing toolkit built just for associations. Today, more than 800 associations use Feather to power the digital marketing for all of their key programs, like virtual events, membership campaigns, continuing education, and more. To learn more about our technology and do-it-for-you implementation services, check us out at feather.co. That's feather.co. And if you've got feedback about the show or would like to join as a guest, shoot us an email at podcast@feather.co. See you on the next one.